And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and we invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions tonight about birds. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 articles on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two kids live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Hey, Bill, our lights aren't on. Are the mics working? Are they
yep,
hot?
They're okay. Up. Yep.
Well, the lights aren't working.
Can you hear yourself?
Are the lights on?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear, so
okay,
good.
Well, that's interesting.
Okay.
We got another thing to fix in the studio. So.
Yeah.
Well, we invite you to call in tonight, folks, with your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And also, if you have any photos you'd like Cliff to identify, those must be sent in during the show to my email address at wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett with two T's on Beckett at lsus.edu. And Cliff is joining us tonight, and we're going to introduce our special guest in a little while, but right now we want to refresh folks on our conservation tip from last month.
Yeah, last month we ended with a conservation tip of a conservation easement announcement. So this is very different from what most people think of with an easement. They think about a utility easement where a pipeline or an electric line or phone line goes across a property, and sometimes you have to give up rights for people to service those lines. But this is very, very different. This is a voluntary written agreement between the landowner and the holder of the easement, which is typically a nonprofit conservation group called a land trust. And so this is an agreement whereby the landowner voluntarily restricts certain uses of the property, like the right to subdivide or develop the property. So it's really intended for those landowners that have big properties that want to keep it intact and want to keep it for wildlife and keep it together and keep it from being subdivided and whittled up. But because that's one of our biggest challenges with wildlife conservation is land chunks are getting smaller and smaller, and wildlife needs bigger chunks of real estate. So if anybody's interested in learning more about conservation easements, even if you're not from Texas, there's a really useful website by the Texas Land Trust Council that you can go to. It's a great resource to learn more about conservation easements. Their website is texaslandtrustcouncil.org. O-R-G. So that's a really good place to go to look at what you can do with a conservation easement. One thing I didn't mention earlier is you can get a significant tax break or tax benefit from doing an easement. So if that sounds like something you want to do with your hundreds or thousands of acres, this is not what you do to your property in the city. This is going to be for rural lands mostly, or unless you do have a lot of acres right in town. We've seen a lot of properties in the hill country that have decided to do this, and that it's great not only for wildlife, but for water in places of the country where water protection is really difficult to do, where you have runoff issues with too much pavement, too much rooftop, that you can have these bigger properties to help everybody with better runoff. Conservation easements, look into it.
And what is your profile species that we're going to feature this month?
In this episode, we're going to profile one of our nation's most widespread ducks, the blue-winged teal. Like most ducks, this species is not very musical, as heard here. Thank you. There we go. So in this recording, you heard two different sounds, that high peeping, the whistling peep. That's the male blue-winged teal. And that quack, quack, quack you heard, that's the female blue-winged teal. So everything you heard there was blue-winged teal. It's just male versus female. The blue-winged teal is a small member of the puddle duck group, meaning it can launch itself straight up when departing a body of water. That means that it does not require a running start on water like its diving duck counterparts. Small numbers of blue-winged teal breed in the coastal prairies of Louisiana and Texas, plus very rarely and spottily throughout the states in the Red River Radio listening area. In my state, there are also low numbers of breeding blue-winged teal in the high plains of the Texas Panhandle. This is one of the first ducks to migrate in fall and one of the latest in spring. Some overwinter with us, but most pass through to winter along the Gulf Coast, the Caribbean, or throughout Central America and parts of South America. Males showing up here in September are mostly in a drab plumage known in waterfowl lingo as the Eclipse Drake, because the bold colors and patterns of the male are missing. This arrival in September is also why an early teal season was created during the second half of the month, while the regular duck season, despite a few exceptions, typically begins in early November. The male teal in breeding plumage has a noticeable and striking white crescent between the eye and the bill on an otherwise dark gray head. The female looks like most female dabbling ducks, but she has a relatively long black bill. In flight, the upper blue and white wing pattern of this species is nearly identical to that of the cinnamon teal and the northern shoveler. Teal like to forage in shallow water, including mud flats and shallow marshy ponds where they eat seeds and plant material. In 2011, the North American population estimate for the blue-winged teal was 8.9 million individuals, making it the second most abundant duck, second to the mallard. To see a beautiful photo of a male blue-winged teal taken by James Childress of Lufkin, visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And I would say that is a striking photo that James did on that one.
Yes.
Very, very beautiful.
He did.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any calls about our birding world are welcome. And Cliff, you have a special guest with you this week. Could you tell us about...
I brought a buddy with me. His name is Taylor Massey, and he's a student at SFA, and he has been working on a neat little project regarding bird calls that we're going to talk about. But let's first turn it over to Taylor, and tell us a little bit about yourself, Taylor.
Well, I'm originally from the Austin, Texas area, so not native to the East Texas, Louisiana region. However, decided to come to SFA and pursue a degree in forestry with a focus in wildlife management to aid in my eventual goal of becoming a wildlife biologist.
All right. So how did you get involved with Bird Calls radio show? Is this part of your college class or what happened?
Well, as a student of the natural sciences, I'm always looking for more opportunities to gain experience, and so I reached out to Cliff and inquired if he had any projects that he was working on, and I was lucky enough to be able to land this, and essentially I've just been compiling all the demographic data from the radio show, compiling, you know, the locality from which the caller is calling from, their sex, and as well as the state that they're calling from, and their topic of question.
Great. So you looked at past or listened to past shows. So tell all the listeners how you access past shows that they're available and how to do that.
Well, it's actually quite easy. All you have to do is go to the Red River Radio website, and from there you can either search or click on Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. And then from there, they have all the previous radio broadcasts in podcast form that you can listen to, starting from the most recent one to the earliest one in 2013.
Great. So the show was born in 2013. It's a little over almost 6.5 years old. You basically compiled all the information you could from the radio show. Tell us how you actually did it, because, you know, I scribble down notes when I do this show. I write down, okay, Bob from Shreveport. And I had a lot of missing gaps. And so the first thing I did with Taylor, as a volunteer, I said, well, I need you to fill in the gaps. Well, tell us what you did next, Taylor.
Well, yes, I went back and tried to kind of just fill in the gaps and go through the podcast that way. However, I found it easier to just go back and listen to the entire thing. And plus, I found it very informational and became a really big fan of the show. And so I rather enjoyed going back and listening to all the radio broadcasts. So, yeah, it was almost 50 hours worth of listening.
Wow. How long did that take you? Probably several months.
It took me several months, yeah. Yes, sir, balancing still a full course load and a job and everything. This was just a side project.
So really, you're our first bird call binger.
That's right.
I'm a
super fan.
I hadn't thought of that. You know, Netflix are always having these shows and HBO Go, and mm-hmm. and now Bird Calls has that. You can binge all the shows. I like that. Great. So Taylor, how many questions has Bird Calls fielded over the years?
Well, over the years, since 2013, we have had 486 total callers. And predominantly, they were male. The male sex has dominated the calls, with 73% being male.
Wow.
And I use the term sex there for a reason instead of gender, because sex is a biological construct and gender is a social construct. So although in today's world, gender can be kind of an ambiguous term, in the biological sense, you know, there are only two sexes that exist in nature.
That's right. So, wow, almost three quarters of the callers are male. That's
I know. Come on, ladies. We got to get losing the battle of the sexes here.
That's right. So explain to our listeners how we only ask for the caller's first name and where they call from. So things like Bob from Shreveport or Sharon from Tyler, they're quite anonymous. But if you could ask callers one or two more questions about themselves, what would you want to ask?
Well, the first thing I'd like to ask is probably not something people want to be asked. I'd like to know people's ages, because that can really give us a good demographic and let us know just who's listening and how old they are. And that can really tell us a lot about our population of listeners.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the male sex is calling the most. What about states? How many states have called in?
We've had calls from all over the United States, Georgia, Idaho, Maine, some very far off places. However, Texas and Louisiana are the two most common states. Texas barely edging out Louisiana by about 5% for the top state that calls in.
Wow, did Louisiana hear that? Texas going to beat just a little bit?
This is all the Louisiana folks. Come on, Louisiana folks. Call in 800-552-8502.
All right, so
it's a challenge.
Stepping down the geography, what cities are calling most frequently? You compiled that.
Well, the most common cities are Shreveport, Nacogdoches, and Bossier. So, I mean, you've got Shreveport and Bossier City right here, the home crowd. But then you've also got Nacogdoches with a large listening crowd, as well as Longview. It's up there as well.
Yeah. And Tyler's only been added, what, Bill, 1 year now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be increased in great number once those people in Tyler know we're on the air. Okay, here's a question I have. What are callers asking about? Which topics come up the most? Because you compile that as well.
Well, the most common reason people call in is for bird identification. A lot of people call in, they've seen a bird or took a picture of a bird or heard a bird, and they want to know or ascertain exactly what that was. But some of the most common species that people are interested in are woodpeckers, hummingbirds, especially purple martins. That's a really popular bird for suburbs, and a lot of people really enjoy them. Some other big ones, cardinals are a very popular topic, as well as Mississippi kites, which I didn't really expect and I didn't really know much about before this show. However, a lot of people are very interested in the Mississippi kite.
Cool.
Well, Taylor, you know, we get a lot of interesting questions. So what are some of the most interesting ones from your perspective that you heard when you went through all of these shows that we've gotten from callers?
Yes, sir. Well, I'm glad you asked that, Bill, because one comes to mind whenever you asked that question. In July of 2018, a gentleman named Matt called in and asked Cliff, what bird reminds you most of a dinosaur?
Oh, and so, I remember that one.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting question, and it actually sparked a few other calls calling into, you know, people calling in and saying what reminds them most of a dinosaur. I think crested caracara was one of them, and I think, Cliff, you mentioned greater roadrunner was
yep,
yours.
And somebody sent in a picture of a young green heron, I believe it was. It was a young heron of some sort. I think it was green, and that looked very dinosaur-esque.
Looked like a raptor.
Yeah, and I agree with you. That was a great question that Matt asked. What year was that?
2018.
So last year. That was a good one. Does there seem to be a time of the year when we get more calls to bird calls, or is there really no pattern at all?
It seems to be highly variable. Towards the end of the year, October, November, December, typically the calls kind of decrease. However, in January, they typically spike back up. And so really there's no pattern that's really identifiable by it. It's mostly just random, and I think it kind of depends on the month.
So curious, you know, I've done research before, and a lot of it can be tedious. What was the part of this that you actually most enjoyed?
Well, I enjoyed learning about birds. I'm a birder myself, and so getting on with this project was really beneficial to me and my education as well. And so I just found it very fascinating, got to learn about the natural things around me.
So you're assuming, though, that we're telling the truth on this show, right? So
well, I think everyone is assuming that. We're trusting you.
Let's hope so.
Well, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now, folks. We have lines open, and we do have two callers online, so we want to get to those. 800-552-8502, the number to call to get in right now. That's 800-552-8502. And our first question is from Shreveport, and it is a female, Mary, calling in. Mary, what's your question tonight?
First, let me say that I am a grandmother. I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but
gotcha.
I'm a grandmother. So the other day, I was on Lyon Avenue in Shreveport in the Highland area, and I was coming out of a store, and I looked up, and across, way across, like six blocks away, in the very top of the tallest pine tree that I could see from there, looking east, there was an enormous, it looked like a penguin jumping up and down on this pine tree, on the top of the pine tree. And I determined, I tried to take some pictures with my phone camera, but I couldn't really get a good picture, and I determined I would go track it down. So I drove around the neighborhood a little bit, and I found the tallest tree in the whole neighborhood, this pine tree, and I could see this enormous hawk staring down at me, keeping watch over all the neighborhood, and I was just awestruck, you know, what a beautiful creature.
Hey.
So my question is, the post officer passed by in his truck. I said, "Did you see that hawk?" He said, "Yes, it's been here for several days." So how big is the range of a hawk like that? I know they do very useful things in the urban environment.
Right.
They take care of pests and, you know,
just keep your cats out of their way.
They do a number on rodents, and it depends on the raptor. Some raptors eat insects too, so they can keep pesky insects away. So the answer to the question really depends on what the species was. So did you get an idea? I mean, there are bald eagles that are in urban settings. What you mentioned penguins, so I assume that means black and white or dark and white bird.
Well, the breast was buff colored, you know, pale.
Okay.
The breast and the legs were substantial looking, you know, with same color of feathers. And
right.
I couldn't really, as close as I could get, I couldn't even really see the shape of the head.
Right. Well, I'm going to take a guess that it was a red-tailed hawk. You know, they don't really have a red tail. And the dorsal side, the back side of it, is an orangey terracotta color that you won't see through the tail when it's sitting there. It'll just look pale. But that is the most common hawk that's big that would be sitting atop a tree. And so I'm going to guess red-tailed hawk. And so is the question, how big of a territory does it have?
Right.
Yeah.
And how long would it be staying there? And
okay.
Keeping, you know, that's its territory.
Right. Well,
presumably.
So this time of the year, we get a lot of red-tailed hawks that bred to the north and winter with us. And I don't know that anybody's really looked at whether they maintain a discrete territory and how large it is. I know that if you drive along I-20, any stretch of I-20 this time of the year, you can pass lots of posts, fence posts or telephone posts that have red-tailed hawks on them, and they can be really stacked and packed in a short distance. So, and they're usually after rodents in the weedy, grassy roads edge, the rights of way along the road. So I think the answer is that bird maybe found a field or full of rabbits, full of hispid cotton rats. Those are probably two of the top foods it eats. And it's not going to stick around if the cover goes dry. So you'll see a lot of these wintering birds move around a lot in order to find food to keep them going.
It's near Columbia Park in the Highland neighborhood.
Okay.
And my thought was that it's keeping the squirrel population down a little bit.
Squirrel is another one it eats. Yep, yep.
Yeah, rats.
So, yeah, and we need these predators to keep things in check. I mean, in my neighborhood where I live, I wish I had a red-tailed hawk because we are overrun with both fox and gray squirrels and too many of each. And so I would like to have that hawk come to my neighborhood and cull the herd a little bit of the squirrel population. And then we don't ever see the hispid cotton rats unless you're someone out there bush hogging or haying, and you'll see the rats out in those ag fields. But that the red tails really like the hispid cotton rats. That's a really popular food for red tails. So he's doing his job. He'll stick around as long as there's food in the cupboard, so to speak. And when he moves on, it's probably because the food has moved on. So, but that's cool that you saw that, and you said it was six blocks away. Sounds like you've got eagle eyes of your own.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I do. I'm an artist.
Oh.
I really enjoy my vision.
Yeah.
You know.
Well,
seeing,
good. Well,
you know, saying things, but this is a very urban environment.
Yes. And raptors are not opposed to urban environments. There's lots of good, tasty things to eat in a city. So, that's good. We need more hawks. So thanks for the call, Mary.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi.
Yeah, speaking of which, at the University of Florida, where I was at before, I was outside once and literally saw a squirrel. And then the next thing I know, that squirrel was caught by a hawk right there in the middle of campus with people all over the place. He was about 2 feet of. He just came down, grabbed the squirrel, and flew back up.
And the college kids can't learn that in a book. They have to be out on the campus to see that.
Kind of have to
see
that.
Learn about predators and prey. That's cool.
The look on the squirrel's face was, oh, Lord, I'm gone. I mean, he just went limp and just looked at you like, yeah, well, this is it.
His day went downhill.
Exactly. Yeah, bad day. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have lines open now, 800-552-8502, and Dr. Beverly Burden is on the line, and she has a question for Taylor. Burden, you're on line with Cliff and Taylor. What's your question?
Yes, Taylor. What are the hot things in entomology right now, doing the type of demographic work that you're doing, is geospatial analysis using GIS. Have you talked to anybody about that?
No, ma'am. We've looked at just the most common cities that have been called from and kind of compiled some data from that. So that's really the only spatial aspect we have for this project.
Well, I would really encourage you to look into that because it's really a hot, it's not a new topic, but it's getting hot and hotter. And you said that you wanted to develop new skills. And also being in wildlife management, I definitely think you ought to look into GIS. If Stephen F. Austin, if FSU offers anything like that. And I don't mean to be a commercial, but we do have online GIS courses from LSUS.
Hmm.
And so don't look around and ask about that, because I think it would look really great on your CV or your resume in years to come.
Yes, ma'am. I've taken several GIS courses, and for some of my other upper-level classes, we do need to create maps. So I'm familiar with GIS. However, for this project, we didn't really incorporate it more than just compiling a map of the most common cities that we will put on our poster.
Well, Cliff, it sounds like a great show already.
Great.
I'll sign off now.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Burden. And by the way, Dr. Burden will be with us next Tuesday night for the next edition of What's Bugging You, another program that we do here at Red River Radio. You are listening to Bird Calls. We have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502 and 800-552-8502. And Taylor, I'm going to ask you one more question here, and that is, after this show, what do you plan to do with all this demographic data and the results that you've furnished?
Well, I plan on taking all of these data to the Texas chapter of the Wildlife Society Conference. It'll be in Corpus Christi this year, and it's a large annual gathering for wildlife professionals and biologists across the state of Texas. And so basically I'll compile all of these data into a poster, a very visual specimen, and kind of just have a poster seminar there at the meeting, and other people can come by and view it and ask me questions and learn a little bit about how radio is still important in today's world as a medium for releasing information.
Yeah, and that's in mid-February of 2020.
Where is it at again?
In Corpus.
Okay, Corpus,
yeah.
Christi.
Yeah.
So. All right,
yeah.
So folks, all of our fans can come down there and join you guys.
Yeah, that'd be kind of fun.
That would be great.
We need some Corpus Christi callers now from Bird Calls, 800-552-8502. Well, Cliff, we do take photographs, and we did get one in this time, just one. But this is an image from Alan in Longview, and he writes, "I've been seeing this bird for the last few days. It acts kind of like a mockingbird when feeding on the ground. It will raise its wings like a mockingbird, but the white color seems unusual. I have a few more pictures of it in a video that he took with his phone." We do have one of his photographs up on our website right now. And Cliff, this is it's a pasty white bird.
Yes.
Beautiful feathers, but it does have the shape of a mockingbird. But
yes, and Alan nailed it. It is a mockingbird. It's just got a odd abnormality and lack of plumage, and it's what we call a leucistic. I'll spell that word, L-E-U-C-I-S-T-I-C, leucistic. So leucism is, most people would have called it an albino or a partial albino, but it's not. This is just a dilution of color. And so the bird's not completely white, but it's very pale. And so normally where a mockingbird would have a lot of gray, this bird is almost white. And so I encourage you to go to the website that Bill just mentioned, that picture's up, and you can see what a leucistic mockingbird looks like that one of our callers, Alan, sent to us, which is really cool. Thanks for doing that, Alan. And if people are interested, just Google the word leucism and look to see how it's defined. And then go to Google Images and put in leucism or leucistic birds, and you'll see all kinds of species of birds that exhibit this phenomenon known as leucism. Lots of robins and chipping sparrows and house sparrows and on and on. This is just an odd feature for every, I don't know, millionth bird will have some odd feathering, some odd coloring. And this one is really noticeable when you see a typical bird like your backyard mockingbird that is kind of looks like he got dipped in white color. But you can still see hints of the mockingbird color. They're just diluted.
Now, is this a genetic abnormality?
It is. And so this is not an indication that the sky is falling. This is not an indication that there's any foul play. Can we use that on a bird show, foul play?
Yes, I think.
It's spelled different. Okay. Yes. So, but it's a really cool picture, and I've seen a few leucistic birds, but I have seen a leucistic mockingbird. There was one in Nacogdoches somebody found about 20 years ago, and I remember seeing it. If people remember the old restaurant La Hacienda, there was one that was hanging around the grounds of Laha 20, maybe closer to 30 years ago, and it was really cool to see. So I bet Alan had a really cool time watching his leucistic mockingbird.
So there's no prophecies in any of the in any of the literature out there about you know, if you see the white mockingbird, doom is on the horizon.
Yeah, I hope not. That would be bad. So
there you go. Well, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and we do have another call online. We have all the other lines open, folks, so you can get in right now. Garrett from Nacogdoches, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff, thanks for taking my call. I'm in Nacogdoches, and I was sitting in my backyard with my wife last week, and we heard this sound about dusk, sound just like a monkey call, like a ooh ah, 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 and I'm pretty sure it was not a barred owl, but it was striking.
Okay. Well, it was a barred owl. It's the monkey call of the barred owl. And let's see, Bill, if you have that one. It's
I don't know whether we got the monkey call because
I imitate it. If we don't have it, I'll do it.
It was very, like, I thought for sure it was a monkey, and my wife did not think it sounded.
Yeah, that's the typical call that he's playing. That's not the.
It was kind of like that, but less hooty. You know, I kind of know.
Not that one either. That's the squeal they do.
Right.
No, it is. It's,
I think those are the only two that I have.
I guess for a small fee, Garrett, I'm going to imitate it for you online. How about that? So
great.
So it you know, the bird watchers call it the monkey call. It's a cacophony, or actually it's caterwauling. If you look up caterwauling and barred owls, you'll hear and on and on, and then later you'll finally hear the the standard call. But what you heard was
first part was it for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So you heard the caterwauling of the barred owl, and it does sound like monkeys.
Dusk is that kind of time.
Yeah, it's definitely a pair thing. They do that when they're super excited about something, because you'll hear both of them kind of duetting that caterwauling together. And if there's another pair getting too close, if the territories are, you know, up against a fence, so to speak, and the neighbors are getting a little too close, you'll hear a lot of caterwauling when they're upset. So, or they're excited. It doesn't mean it's bad communication. It could mean that they were excited and communicating. But that's caterwauling barred owls.
All right.
Yeah, that's cool that you heard it.
It's pretty neat. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, there was a flock of yellow-breasted birds in our yard this past weekend. Is there something coming through right now?
Flock of, you said white-breasted?
Small birds, like warbler-sized, dark beaks. I didn't hear their call.
You said yellow-breasted or white?
Yellow.
Okay. I have been seeing a lot of pine warblers flocking up, and they've got a lot of yellow on them, especially the males, and they'll even feed on the ground. This time of the year, they'll be low in the trees. They're also high in the trees. They're all over. But I've noticed that in the last 3 or 4 weeks, pine warblers doing that. And maybe that was your bird. There's goldfinches as well. They're going to start showing up in big numbers here shortly. But they've lost a lot of their gold color. They get pretty drab. But I would think maybe pine warblers. And I saw a flock with a few people last week that was probably pushing 20 to 25 individuals. That's not unusual with pine warblers in the winter. They'll get in big flocks. So that's what I'm guessing you had. Yeah. Cool.
Hey, Cliff, I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Garrett.
All right, thank you, Garrett. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And all lines are open right now. You can get right in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. When he talked about the cackling, I thought we were going to go to this one.
Oh, the laughing.
Yeah,
that one
reminds me kind of monkeys
right.
laughing up in the trees.
Right.
So that's the pileated,
that's
of course.
That's the pileated woodpecker, right.
Which so. I never would have known had I not been working on this show.
That's
so.
Right. There's a job perk for you.
Yeah, now when I hear that in the movies, I say, that bird doesn't belong in Africa, you know?
Well, actually, that becomes a big issue if you like movies and television like I do. Knowing your bird calls can be kind of a problem because you're watching a movie that's maybe supposed to be in Africa, and you'll hear a blue jay.
Right,
And that bird doesn't occur there at all. And it gets to be a problem. I think I've mentioned this before. There was a golf tournament in Kentucky, and they dubbed a cactus wren over and over, and bird watchers just called and wrote nasty letters because there are no cactus wrens in Kentucky. So, I think Hollywood has had to learn to get the bird sounds correct because there are there's 60 to 70 million bird watchers now in the U.S., and they're paying attention to that kind of stuff.
And they do have moonshine wrens in Kentucky, but no cactus wrens.
That's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can get in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our birding world are welcome, and we hope that you will go ahead and call in right now. I do have a question for you, Cliff, especially with Taylor here, and that is, if you wanted a good history book of the natural history and resources of our area, what would be your best recommendation for anybody who really wants to learn more about both the historical natural resources of this area, but also the current troubles and the current things?
You didn't tell me you were going to ask that question. That's a good one.
Yeah.
But it's one that I'm ready to field. Unless, Taylor, do you want to field it first? Do you have a recommendation? Because I do. And they don't have to be the same answer. So
no, sir. I'll leave it to your good judgment.
And this is when I give talks to college groups like at Taylor's University at SFA, I do mention that the best reading assignment you can make if you want to learn about the ecology of the Piney Woods, and this would apply here in Louisiana as well. It's a book called Land of Bears and Honey by Joe Truitt and Dan Lay. It was published by UT Press, and I think it was in the 80s. I don't remember the actual year. I would have been prepared, but this is a good question that I wasn't prepared for. But I do know the title. Again, Land of Bears and Honey by Truitt and Lay, and it is the best part of it. It's a really good read, and I would encourage that book for anyone listening to this show that's in the listening area, or even afar. It's just a very good readable book, and it explains how this is a land of fire. That was a big part of the forest system here. And you can learn a lot more about the ecology in a very readable format. So, yeah, that's what I'd recommend, especially I'm looking at Taylor, who's sitting next to me, and now he's got his homework assignment, Land of Bears and Honey, and he's going to have it read by the spring semester?
Hey, I already did 50 hours of listening. I might need a little more time for that.
Yeah, there you go. Good answer. You're exempt, but all the kids in your classes need to read it for sure.
Well, that's good. I'll definitely remember that.
And the readability of it, I've read a number of books on, the local ecology, and some of them are just not readable.
Exactly. I'm not going to recommend a textbook-type read that's going to put you to sleep. This one will not put you to sleep. If you have any interest in nature, you're gonna love it. And so, unfortunately, both the authors have passed away, but by producing this book, their legacy lives on, and their knowledge and passion live on. So I really encourage people to get a copy and read it. It's fantastic.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have two callers online. George from Bossier, please hang on the line for a few minutes. And Krista Lynn from Shreveport, you're up next with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff.
Hey.
Really pleased to be able to talk to you. I listen to you every week.
All right.
For the past 10, 11 years, I have worked at a camp at Walter B. Jacobs where there are a number of birds of prey housed there. And so I find myself feeling like, a mediocre ornithologist, mm-hmm. because I like to, when I see them out in public when I'm driving around, I like to point them out. But sometimes, because they're so far away, it's hard for me to really make out what it is.
Yeah.
So, like, Mary, who called earlier, was talking about the hawk, and I assumed it would be a red-tailed hawk as well, because I live in Highland, and I know for certain I've seen some red-tailed hawks around. But I wonder, how often do we encounter other birds of prey in Shreveport this time of year? I know I can identify a hawk pretty much when I see the distinctive tail.
Yeah.
But sometimes the tail doesn't look too red. So I don't know if it's a falcon, if it's a kite. Like, what is really going to populate this area this time of year? And what can we expect to see around, like, the evening time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm going to start by saying that the red-tailed hawk comes in so many different color patterns that no two often look alike. So this is the larger, and you're familiar with it because you've worked with them. This is the larger, chunkier, stockier hawk. And so red tails, it can be a red tail over and over, and you're looking and going, it sure doesn't look like the last one, but they don't all look the same with red tails. There's so many different color varieties. A couple things that they have in common, most of them have what we call a belly band. It's some irregular streaking across the chest or belly, and that's usually pretty uniform. That's on the belly. If you look on the backside, most red tails have some irregular white splatches or splotches on the back too. Not many, but that that breaks up just a uniform dark back. So I think red tail is going to be my number one answer. There are a lot of red-shouldered hawks that's a little smaller than red-tailed. And when you get out into the ag fields, there's going to be a lot of kestrels. The old name is the sparrowhawk, and they're little. Okay. They're not much bigger than a mourning dove. They're a little bit bigger than a mourning dove. Yeah, and they're a falcon. So they've got the pointy wings and the longer tail, and they really can zip around. So those might be the top three hawks and relatives for this time of the year. And again, red-tailed, red-shouldered, and American kestrel in that order is what I would. So okay. That's a great question. I like that. And you sound like you're really paying attention to those hawks, and I guess you like them too, right?
My fiance gets annoyed by me because I always point them out when I see them on the highway.
Well, he's your fiance. When you all get married, you got lots of choices of names for kids. Hawk, kestrel.
That is such a see.
You know,
falcon.
Falcon. Yeah. So you got some cool names. Yeah.
Just don't use buzzard.
No.
No, we won't use them.
That's right. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank y'all so much.
Bye-bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lines open. John from Fishville, please stay on the line for a few minutes because we've got George from Bossier up next. George, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I had an unusual thing happen about 2 weeks ago. I was in my backyard talking to my neighbor. And he's an old hunter, and he'd said that we're overrun with rabbits here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, something's getting these rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
He said, there's one over there, and I guess the remains or something. And I said, yeah, it's probably that bird that was eating the doves over across the street. And he said, well, something's around because that rabbit just took off, and that dove just flew away. I'm like, okay, Marvin. So, but just as soon as he said it, this raptor landed on the fence, not more than, I don't think, 20 feet away from
him. Yeah.
And I was just stunned. I was like, this bird has landed this close. I looked at the bird and I had no time to get a camera.
Yeah.
But it didn't look like a red-tailed hawk to me. It looked much smaller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, I bet you had either a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk. Those are, in addition to Crystal Lynn's question, I would add those as also abundant, or not abundant, but common this time of the year. And they do like cities, they like urban areas, and they're both bird eaters. So I bet it was, you know, looking at the dove, he's not going to eat the rabbit. But they're looking at the dove, they're looking at the blue jays and the other birds. And so I bet if you look after we hang up, look up Cooper's hawk and sharp-shinned hawk. And so they're almost mirror images of each other. It's just that the Cooper's hawk is typically a little bigger than the sharp-shinned hawk. But I bet you that's what you had, George.
No, that sounds right. I'll grab the book when I get off the phone. I have one more question.
Sure.
For the longest time, I was watching red-tailed hawks. But then a couple of years ago, I got interested in another bird that I couldn't identify. And I called you, and it was a Mississippi kite.
Oh.
Well, I've been watching these birds for the longest time. And it appears to me that the Mississippi kite leaves, like, turn off a switch.
Yeah.
They're just gone.
Yes.
And then the red-tailed hawks show up.
Yep.
And I kept thinking about it. And you'd said that the Mississippi kite eats insects.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched them, some of the most amazing aerobatics out where I work with these Mississippi kites flying around a tree. Anyways, it's the food, isn't it?
Yes.
The Mississippi kite split when the bugs split.
Yeah, that's right, man. Good observation, George. That's right. The Mississippi kite really favors large insects on the wing, dragonflies, moths, grasshoppers. They're actually flying up high, and that's what they're after. And when that kind of shuts down in the fall, so does the Mississippi kite, and they're highly migratory. So our Mississippi kites head to South America, and they leave us in July, August. You really see them pouring through, and they're still pouring through in September, and then getting into October, they're almost all gone. And so that's what happens to your Mississippi kites, and they'll be back next spring. So watch for them in April.
Well, that's one of my goals, is to get a picture of a Mississippi kite getting a dragonfly. I've got a good photograph of what's the bird that eats so many bugs?
Purple martins?
Purple martin. I got a purple martin with a dragonfly
in
his beak. But and it's very difficult to catch. I can't catch them in the air.
Yeah,
it's really difficult to track them.
Yeah.
But listen, I really appreciate your show.
Great.
You sound terrific. And
great.
I was just wondering, are you ever going to come down to LSUS or BPSC, Bossier Parish Community College?
For what?
For a
speaking engagement?
Yes, sir.
No, I don't think so. I'm hoping that this radio show will be enough, because it keeps me pretty busy. So, but I appreciate the interest and the invitation. And George, we're glad you like the show. And
one more thing, George, we'd love to see that photograph of the purple martin with the dragonfly.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got a packet of photographs I've been meaning to send to you.
Yeah.
And I'll get it on the way this week.
Okay.
Cool. Great.
Right.
Thanks for the call, George.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lines filling up right now, so we're going to move fast. John from Fishville, you are next. What's your question for Cliff?
Oh, Cliff, you got a great show going on.
Hey. All right. Thanks, John.
A few years ago, I had a good bat house out on a pole, and boy, they were busy, and I had it there for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden the power company came through and put a transformer 20 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the bats left.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, how far away from those transformers do you expect the bats are sensitive to that?
Well, I don't know that we can't rule out coincidence. So I'm not convinced that the transformer is the bad guy here.
Huh.
So I think that one thing I've learned with bat houses, and I've put several up on my property, rural property we have, and I've seen other people do it over the years, you've got less than 5% chance of occupancy. That's very, very low.
Wow.
And I would think it's closer to less than 1%. So bat houses, they sound like a great idea, and I don't want to knock anyone that's putting them up, and I certainly don't want to knock the people building them, but the chances of success are extremely low. So I don't know that it's just coincidence that that your bats moved on, because bats like those houses are, you know, the dominant one is the Mexican free-tailed bat, and it's very migratory like a lot of the birds that we talk about. And so I don't know if timing when you saw this was related to the weather. And so they could have migrated out of there. They could have moved because of food. They may be moved because they go to maternity colonies, depending on the time of year. There's a lot more going on with bats, and I don't claim to be a bat expert, but I wouldn't rule out coincidence with what you observed, John.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what's a good resource for figuring, getting the rules down, for instance, the height of that house to be installed?
The go-to place for me is the Bat Conservation International, and that's BCI. They're based in Austin, but they work globally with bats, and they have a lot of good information on their website. So I'd go to Bat Conservation International's website and look for that information there.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot, Cliff. I really enjoy I check in with you every time you're on the radio.
Boy. Okay, thank you, John.
Visit later.
Bye.
All right, thank you, John. And we're going to go to our next caller. We've got two more, so we have to make these quick. Jerry from Raleigh, Mississippi. You are on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Okay, I got a bird that I've been told is a mockingbird, but I ain't never heard a mockingbird go like, he'll whistle fast, and then four more times.
He whistles fast and does it four more times, same thing?
It's not fast, it's kind of slow.
Huh.
I can do it.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, here it go. Do it four times. Sometimes
they
do it one time first.
Yeah, well, the trick with the mockingbird is if you wait when they're finished with that whistle, they'll do something else, and they'll chirp something else, and then again and again, just different stuff. So are you hearing anything else besides the whistle?
No, that's all it does.
Okay. Well, then it's not a mockingbird. It's not a mockingbird if that's all you're hearing.
Yeah, it does the same way every time.
Okay. Well, I mean,
that was the first time I ever heard it when I was in Mississippi.
Okay. Well, they usually spice things up. And what mockingbirds do is a vocalization, usually in three or more, and then they'll switch to something else. And they'll do, you know, 20 different vocalizations in 2 minutes. So to hear just that one whistle over and over just leans away from being a mockingbird. And I don't know what you had there.
So, I don't know, because I had never heard it.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, well, if it's a mockingbird, it's a Mississippi mockingbird.
Yeah, he doesn't have good repertoire, does he? So, all right. Well, thanks for the call, Jerry.
All right. Thank you, Jerry. And we're going to go to our next caller, which is Mike, and he's from Jacksonville, Texas. Mike, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, I was gonna suggest maybe what about a shrike for the last caller?
Good call, Mike. Yes, the shrike does look like a mockingbird. It's gray and white, a little black, and it does make a funny whistle that will do over and over. You nailed it, Mike. I like that answer. When can you come on the show and take over for me?
I don't know about that, but
yeah, no, that's totally right. I like that answer a lot because it looks just like a mockingbird and has the whistle that he described. So, yeah, I think Jerry's mystery bird is the loggerhead shrike, also known as the butcher bird. So, cool, Mike. Well, thanks for pulling me out of that hole.
Sure.
You saved me.
I don't know. I might be stepping on your toes here, but I'd heard some people calling in about hawks, and I'd seen a sharpshin chasing a bird today, and I thought I'd mention some of the ones that I found most common, and maybe you'd want to comment and, you know, say, oh, no, not that. Or
yeah. So I did add Cooper's and Sharpshin to my list of three that I gave Crystal Lynn. So we're up to five species. Did you have anything else to add? What else?
Well, of course, red-tailed, and a lot of the red-tails I'm seeing have a lot of white underneath, although They do have the mini band, too. And the red-shouldered and red-tailed are the two most common.
Yep.
Yeah, I was thinking red-shouldered.
Yep, and that's what I said. Those were the top two. And then I said Kestrel, and then I added Cooper's and Sharpshin, so there's your top five. We could argue the order, but definitely I think you and I definitely agree red-tailed's number one, and that's what I think too. So,
and also northern harrier.
Yeah, harrier, if you get out in the grasslands, the harrier is pretty common in more ag land, grassland areas. So cool. Well, thanks for helping on that call, Mike. I appreciate it. You figured out the mystery bird. Very good.
Great.
All right.
I had a question for you.
Okay.
You have a second.
Yeah.
I wondered, the goldfinches and, what's the name of that other one? I just flew out of my head.
Pine siskin?
Right, yes, pine siskin. I wondered how the pine siskin, how those populations were doing.
The pine siskin is doing pretty good, and so is the goldfinch. I mean, you know, the goldfinch is one of our top 10 most abundant birds in the U.S., maybe top 15, I don't have exactly, but they are in decline, so that don't get me wrong. Goldfinches are in decline, but there's still quite a lot of them, and same with pine siskins, and luckily they both come to our backyard feeders. So watch for them soon.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for that call. And we're going to wrap up the show here this week. Cliff, you want to remind folks we're coming up with our Christmas bird count. Can you tell folks about that real quick,
yeah,
and then we'll go into our conservation tip?
Yeah. Every year we provide some dates for several Christmas bird counts in our listening area, and we can bring it up again in the next episode. But if you go to the Red River Radio website, Bill has posted up all the dates and locations, and also, most importantly, the compilers. And I want to thank those compilers for doing what they do, compiling Christmas bird counts and picking dates. And you'll see their email address. And if you live in those areas where they have a Christmas count, contact those compilers, and that they will use you as an observer. And we'll talk more about the Christmas bird count in the December issue.
All right. And finally, what's our conservation tip for this month?
So tonight we're going to talk about avoiding runoff in our waters. Every living thing requires a little H2O, including you and me. Natural waters, including rivers, wetlands, ponds, and the ocean, are vital to the survival of everything occurring in and around them, which means they need lots of attention and protection to keep them working for us. Let's keep our wetlands and waterways free of foreign objects because they can cause serious problems. For example, since 1991, lead shot has been illegal in the U.S. for waterfowl hunting. The species we profiled earlier in this episode, the blue-winged teal, is an example of a water bird that would accidentally ingest lead pellets found on the bottom of wetlands, thinking they're seeds. The results would be fatal, lead poisoning, and certain death. Similar threats to birds and other creatures occur when we spray or spread certain chemicals in or adjacent to water. For instance, some weed killers that run off into ponds can make your tadpole sick and vulnerable to predation, which then impacts your local frogs. Farther north, where salt is used on icy roads, that salt runoff has polluted nearby wetlands by dramatically changing the salinity levels of those wetlands and everything that depends on them. Spreading agricultural fertilizers that run off into nearby wetlands can lead to an excess of nutrients and low oxygen levels in natural waters, thus impacting the conditions for fish, frogs, and other wildlife. Next time you're broadcasting chemicals, whether it's herbicides, fertilizers, or something else, keep them far from your wetlands and waterways, and read the label to make sure you're not applying too much. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff, I want to thank you again for joining me for another edition of Bird Calls. And Taylor, thanks so much for traveling up and doing all
thanks,
that work.
It's a pleasure. I'm a huge fan, and I'm glad I got to be a part of it.
And hopefully your mom, Tina, is listening. Go, Tina.
I love you, Mom.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to thank everyone at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program was made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Producers for this show were Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from our phone bank, which included Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, and Brian Boone. Thanks again tonight to Taylor Massey for coming on the show and sharing information he gathered about the radio show. The sound files used tonight were profiled from xenocanto.org, and the recording by Paul Marvin, and this month's bird photo was by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours. Tune in on December 10th for the next Bird Calls from Red River Radio.